History of England, Chapter 12, Part 1. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. History of England, from the Accession of James II, by Thomas Babington Macaulay, Chapter 12, Part 1. William had assumed, together with the title of King of England, the title of King of Ireland. For all our jurists then regarded Ireland as a mere colony, more important indeed than Massachusetts, Virginia, or Jamaica, but, like Massachusetts, Virginia, and Jamaica, dependent on the mother country, and bound to pay allegiance to the sovereign whom the mother country had called to the throne. In fact, however, the Revolution found Ireland emancipated from the dominion of the English colony. As early as the year 1686, James had determined to make that island a place of arms, which might overawe Great Britain, and a place of refuge where, if any disaster happened in Great Britain, the members of his church might find refuge. With this view he had exerted all his power for the purpose of inverting the relation between the conquerors and the aboriginal population. The execution of his design he had entrusted, in spite of the remonstrances of his English councillors, to the Lord Deputy Tyrconnel. In the autumn of 1686 the process was complete. The highest offices in the state, in the army, and in the courts of justice were, with scarcely an exception, filled by Papists. A pettifogger named Alexander Fitton, who had been detected in forgery, who had been fined for misconduct by the House of Lords at Westminster, who had been many years in prison, and who was equally deficient in legal knowledge and in the natural good sense and acuteness by which the want of legal knowledge has sometimes been supplied, was Lord Chancellor. His single merit was that he had apostatized from the Protestant religion, and this merit was thought sufficient to wash out even the stain of his Saxon attraction. He soon proved himself worthy of the confidence of his patrons. On the bench of justice he declared that there was not one heretic in 40,000 who was not a villain. He often, after hearing a cause in which the interests of his church were concerned, postponed his decision, for the purpose, as he avowed, of consulting his spiritual director, a Spanish priest, well read, doubtless, in Escobar. Thomas Nugent, a Roman Catholic who had never distinguished himself at the bar except by his brogue and his blunders, was Chief Justice of the King's Bench. Stephen Rice, a Roman Catholic, whose abilities and learning were not disputed even by the enemies of his nation and religion, but whose known hostility to the Act of Settlement excited the most painful apprehensions in the minds of all who held property under that Act, was Chief Baron of the Exchequer. Richard Nagle, an acute and well-read lawyer, who had been educated in a Jesuit college, and whose prejudices were such as might have been expected from his education, was Attorney General. Keating, a highly respectable Protestant, was still Chief Justice of the Common Pleas, but two Roman Catholic judges sat with him. It ought to be added that one of those judges, Daly, was a man of sense, moderation, and integrity. The matters, however, which came before the Court of Common Pleas were not of great moment. Even the King's Bench was at this time almost deserted. The Court of Exchequer overflowed with business, for it was the only court at Dublin from which no writ of error lay to England, and consequently the only court in which the English could be oppressed and pillaged without hope of redress. Rice, it was said, had declared that they should have from him exactly what the law, construed with the utmost strictness, gave them, and nothing more. What, in his opinion, the law, strictly construed, gave them, they could easily infer from a saying which, before he became a judge, was often in his mouth. "I will drive," he used to say, "a coach and six through the Act of Settlement." He now carried his threat daily into execution. The cry of all Protestants was that it mattered not what evidence they produced before him, that, when their titles were to be set aside, the rankest forgeries, the most infamous witnesses, were sure to have his countenance. To his court his countrymen came in multitudes, with writs of ejectment and writs of trespass. In his court the government attacked at once the charters of all the cities and boroughs in Ireland, and he easily found pretexts for pronouncing all those charters forfeited. The municipal corporations, about 100 in number, had been instituted to be the strongholds of the Reformed religion and of the English interest, and had consequently been regarded by the Irish Roman Catholics with an aversion which cannot be thought unnatural or unreasonable. Had those bodies been remodeled in a judicious and impartial manner, the irregularity of the proceedings by which so desirable a result had been attained might have been pardoned. But it soon appeared that one exclusive system had been swept away, only to make room for another. The boroughs were subjected to the absolute authority of the crown. Towns in which almost every householder was an English Protestant were placed under the government of Irish Roman Catholics. Many of the new aldermen had never even seen the places over which they were appointed to bear rule. At the same time, the sheriffs, to whom belonged the execution of writs and the nomination of juries, were selected in almost every instance from the caste which had till very recently been excluded from all public trust. It was affirmed that some of these important functionaries had been burned in the hand for theft. Others had been servants to Protestants, and the Protestants added, with bitter scorn, that it was fortunate for the country when this was the case, for that a menial who had cleaned the plate and rubbed down the horse of an English gentleman might pass for a civilized being, when compared with many of the native aristocracy, whose lives had been spent in coshering or marauding. To such sheriffs no colonist, even if he had been so strangely fortunate as to obtain a judgment, dared to entrust an execution. Thus the civil power had, in the space of a few months, been transferred from the Saxon to the Celtic population. The transfer of the military power had been not less complete. The army, which, under the command of Ormond, had been the chief safeguard of the English ascendancy, had ceased to exist. Whole regiments had been dissolved and reconstructed. 6,000 Protestant veterans, deprived of their bread, were brooding in retirement over their wrongs, or had crossed the sea and joined the standard of William. Their place was supplied by men who had long suffered oppression, and who, finding themselves suddenly transformed from slaves into masters, were impatient to pay back, with accumulated usury, the heavy debt of injuries and insults. The new soldiers, it was said, never passed an Englishman without cursing him and calling him by some foul name. They were the terror of every Protestant innkeeper, for, from the moment when they came under his roof, they ate and drank everything, they paid for nothing, and by their rude swaggering they scared more respectable guests from his door. Such was the state of Ireland when the Prince of Orange landed at Torbay. From that time every packet which arrived at Dublin brought tidings, such as could not but increase the mutual fear and loathing of the hostile races. The colonist, who, after long enjoying and abusing power, had now tasted for a moment the bitterness of servitude, the native, who, having drunk to the dregs all the bitterness of servitude, had at length for a moment enjoyed and abused power, were alike sensible that a great crisis, a crisis like that of 1641, was at hand. The majority impatiently expected Phelim O'Neill to revive in Tyrconnell. The minority saw in William a second Over. End of Part 1. Read by Kara Schallenberg, www.kray.org, on July 12, 2007, in Oceanside, California.